Hey man, how's it going? All right. I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, I don't know. I guess the news. Maybe it seems like I sent out more invites than I actually did. But then again, I think I sent out a lot of invites. Then again, I got a couple of no's and a whole lot of no answers yet. I used to be really good about scheduling the interviews a couple of days in advance and all this kind of thing. Now, 15 minutes in advance is about as much notice as I give them. And so you wonder why I do such a lousy job of bringing in enough interviews for you lately. I want to interview. Hey, here's a no back from Doug Bandow. Man, who do I gotta take hostage to get Doug Bandow on the show? Jesus, that guy is busy a lot. There's one I gotta just schedule out in advance. I'll tag that one to do. Yeah, there's another note. I think Doug got in a car wreck. Jeez, I hope he's okay. Talk about busy. All right, well, anyway. Israel news on the show today. Islamic State news. War in former Iraq, former Syria. Libya news. Ebola in Texas. And, of course, the pigs. Lots to talk about on the show today. Let me do the Ebola thing, first here. Don't be afraid of Ebola. I mean, if you live in Liberia, be afraid of Ebola, but if you live here, don't be afraid of Ebola, because the thing of it is, even if it starts getting around a little bit, here in the United States, they can track how it spreads well enough and isolate people, well enough to really lock it down. And I'm not saying 1000%, couldn't possibly fail. I mean, we're talking about the CDC, you know, government and their deputies here. But, for the most part, I think they can isolate it. It's not airborne. You'd have to really cough right into somebody's mouth or, sneeze right in their face or where, even then, I don't know if sneezing, I mean, right in their face where they are taking on liquids from you kind of thing. To get it. And you can't spread Ebola unless you are symptomatic. So that it's not like you go around feeling fine for 5 days giving Ebola to everybody you know, and only then do you find out you have Ebola. It doesn't work that way. And so with this case in Dallas, the guy, he may have exposed a couple of few people because he already felt sick and they failed to diagnose him quickly enough. But I think you're going to start seeing emergency rooms asking people if they've been to Western Africa lately, pretty regularly, starting now, even if they didn't then. And anyway, you know, I guess I could sell you some storable food or some crap and try to scare you. Yes, there's such a thing as pandemics and epidemics, but this probably isn't going to hurt you, so don't worry about it. You're much more likely to get killed in a terrorist attack provoked by your government's mass murder of innocent people overseas than die of Ebola. And that's a very small chance. You're much more likely to be murdered by your local deputy sheriff's department who's, get this, their supposed job is protecting you than attacked by terrorists. So, and that's even with the million-plus people Bush and Obama have killed in the last few years. So think you're pretty safe from Ebola. That's all the Ebola coverage I've got for you today. Don't worry about it. All right. Cross that right off my list. As long as I'm talking about the pigs, there are a couple of stories I had here. Oh, yeah, this one, man. This would be enough. It's by Kevin Gottstola at dissenter.firedoglake.com. Does this say yes here? Oh, good deal. Okay, great. I got two guests. I got Murtaza Hussein and Trevor Tim on the show today. Perfect. That'll be right there. And then I put him over here. That'll be Trevor. Good old Trevor, man. I hadn't spoke to him in a little while. Okay, so get back to them in a second. Today on the show, Murtaza Hussein and Trevor Tim, everybody. But now to get back to this, Kevin got stole a piece. Living life in prison without parole for nonviolent drug offenses. Yuka Wadlington and his fight for freedom. So here's this black man who, you know, he lives in America, so he's got no rights that the government is bound to respect. And, hey, that's the law. And so here, his story was highlighted in an ACLU report on A Living Death, which we interviewed. I interviewed them about it on this show. I don't remember the specific case, but anyway. So this case really caught Kevin Gostela's attention. He started emailing back and forth with this guy and learning as much as he can about it. And so now get this guy's story. And he doesn't deny he's guilty of the quote-unquote crime, but check out what happened. What happened was, in 1993 or 1994, it's contradictory here, I guess we'll go with 94, this guy had borrowed $3,000 from another guy in order to open a car wash. Never paid him back. Didn't work out, I guess. 4 years later, the guy that he borrowed money from gets busted by the cops for being a drug dealer. And so what do the cops do? They have him set up a guy who has nothing to do with drugs at all, but owes him money. So he, because they don't care whose lives they destroy at all. They are devils from the pit of hell, the prosecutors. They don't care what they do, the cops. They don't care who they destroy. They don't care whose kids end up in foster care or who ends up hanging from a ceiling fan or, you know, whose business is destroyed and therefore all their employees get laid off and all those consequences and that kind of thing. They don't care at all. So they take this guy who's guilty of the non-crime of dealing drugs and they have him set up a guy who has absolutely nothing to do with the drug trade at all, but happens to owe him $4,000, $3,000. So he has that over the guy. And so then for months and months and months, he tries to get this guy to participate in a drug deal. And finally, he does. But he doesn't even participate in a drug deal. All he does is show up at some fake thing with no drugs, no money. He's only supposed to play some kind of middleman role in the thing anyway. But that's all right. They lock him up and give him two life sentences in federal prison. No parole. For a plan to sell drugs that didn't even really exist. It was a setup the entire time. A guy who was not a criminal, but who was compromised by a criminal, who owed money to a criminal. And as far as we know, a guy who wasn't even a criminal in any real way, and wasn't even a criminal in a technical way until 4 years later. But the guy that he owed money set him up, which lesson to you, don't owe anybody $3,000. They might set you up. But so the government set him up, and the prosecutors, the witnesses, the jurors, whatever, they don't care. They don't care. They just lock you in prison for the rest of your life for nothing. They don't care. That's what being free means. Don't you know that? Participating in the exercise of power. Sitting on a jury and helping convict an innocent man and lock him in a cage like an animal for the rest of his life with no chance of parole ever for a drug deal that never happened, for an entire entrapment case. That's what it means to be free. To pretend that you're a prosecutor for a minute and smash and destroy someone. Isn't that right, jurors of America out there? Isn't that why you live to serve on a jury so you can help conspire with the government to kidnap and destroy innocent people? USA! USA! Come on, say it with me. USA! Hey, the guy was guilty of violating a law that says you're not allowed to be entrapped by a government informant into participating in a drug deal for drugs and money that don't even really exist. The rest of his life in a cage till he's dead. That's it. Your one chance at life. Gone. Bye. It's your fault for being born black, I guess. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show on Liberty Radio Network. I'm here weekdays, noon to 3, LRN.FM. ScottHorton.org for the archives. More than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. There's so many now that I can't update the way I say it, except in increments of 500 now. More than 3,500 interviews there at ScottHorton.org. And pretty much I'm the editor of Antiwar.com, even though I don't have a job there anymore. But you should read Antiwar.com all the time. And follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. All right, so today on the show, Trevor Tim is going to be on. And, man, now I got to decide which thing that he wrote do I want to interview him about, because Trevor Tim has been writing some badass stuff lately. Well, it's the spotlight today on Antiwar.com is one of them. The FBI crying over encrypted iPhones. You know what? I don't know. I think maybe his previous article was more important than that, and I only have him for one segment. I'm going to have to decide. But Trevor has just been kicking ass lately over there at The Guardian. Just been writing really great stuff. This one I didn't even see. 8 questions we must ask Obama about secret war. That's good. Is Obama misleading the world to war? Depends how you define misleading. That was a great one. Ooh, but I can't really ask him about that because that's the other interview coming up here in just a few minutes. Murtaza Hussein co-authored this piece with Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, debunking the propaganda about the Corazon group. And interesting. Oh, I got to make sure to mention to him Roy's piece and what he said about, you know, alienating Nusra's friends. Boy, I cannot spell and talk at the same time. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, and it's libertarian foreign policy mostly, which means I'm against it, and I'm trying to debunk it as best I can for you. First of all, let's talk about Benjamin Netanyahu here. I guess he's at the White House now, something like that. Or will be today. He's going to the White House to meet with Barack Obama. That's one thing that I like about Barack Obama is that his blackness guarantees that Benjamin Netanyahu hates his sorry guts. And Benjamin Netanyahu thinks that Barack Obama ought to probably be cleaning his bathroom or something like that. And so, therefore, Barack Obama's attitude is, oh yeah, well, I'm the leader of the empire and you're the leader of Israel, so kiss my black ass. And so, thank goodness these men don't get along, which I don't know if George W. Bush would have got along any better with Benjamin Netanyahu, really. He never had to put up with the guy. In fact, Bush may have, you know, put him in his place better than Obama, because Obama is such a weakling that, you know, he doesn't really fight back. But at least they don't have a good working relationship together. Remember the open microphone comment with Obama and Sarkozy in France, and Obama telling Sarkozy, you think you hate him? I gotta talk to him every day, or I gotta put up with his nonsense every day. He whined, which Obama likes whining. That's one of his things. That was one of the things he was caught on an open mic whining about, was that Netanyahu is a person in this world. Oy vey. And what a despicable liar Benjamin Netanyahu is. And I wonder, is it just me? Are you guys as offended by the lies as you are the murders? I mean, for me, this is a flaw of mine. I mean, there's just no comparison between Barack Obama, say, for example, or Benjamin Netanyahu exploding an innocent person to death versus lying to me about it. Right? But I'm sorry. This is a flaw of mine, a disorder of mine that, man, I hate being lied to so much. I just hate it. I hate it as much as the actual killing that they're lying about. Because it's a personal insult. It's a test of how stupid am I. And my answer is, I hate you for that. So when Benjamin Netanyahu says, oh yeah, well, you know what? Here's two things that you don't really know very much about, you stupid ass Americans. ISIS and Hamas, they're the same thing. You know what they have in common? Muslims, Arabs, and you not knowing anything about them. So, here, pass this test of your stupidity, America, and accept it as true when I instruct you that Hamas is the same as ISIS. He's calling you stupid. He's lying to your face. It's a test to see whether you will stay loyal to your previous decisions under such cognitive dissonance and pressure, whether you're going to side with him and his lie, your team that you've already decided to identify with. If you're an American in the super majority, then you just love Israel. Or whether you're going to buck and say, wait a minute, you know what? There's a line where you can cross it, Mr. Prime Minister of Israel, that I love so much, and it's when you lie to me so blatantly for so long about so many things, I'm starting to suspect that maybe you don't mean well. Starting to take it as a personal insult. The only time there was ever an Al-Qaeda-like group in the Gaza Strip, Hamas killed them all to death. There hasn't been an Al-Qaeda group in Gaza since 2009, when Hamas shot them and exploded them and killed them. Hamas has no ties, no anything in common with Al-Qaeda at all. What does Netanyahu say when he's lying to your face? He says they're from the fruit of the same poisonous tree. But you got to fill in the gap. You know what he means. They're Muslims. They're Arabs. Maybe he means they're Sunnis. That's all you need to know. They are the enemy. And they are to be vanquished. And so, don't waste his time trying to parse who's who lives where, who has authority where, whose ideology or politics or religious beliefs actually signify what. Nah. All you need to know is he likes killing Gazans. And since you have a new enemy that you're scared of, he just goes, oh, look, yeah, ISIS and the people that I want to kill are the same. Oh, by the way, and Gazans are all Hamas too. Even though, of course, that's not true either. That's like saying it's okay for Osama to kill Americans just because Bill Clinton or George W. Bush, the blood-soaked monsters, are the presidents of America. Not true. Never true. Anyway, there you go. The despicable child killer and land rustler and liar, Benjamin Netanyahu, everybody. Give him a big round of applause. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Murtaza Hussein. He's a reporter for The Intercept at firstlook.org/The Intercept. And here he's got a piece co-authored with Glenn Greenwald, The Fake Terror Threat Used to Justify Bombing Syria. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. So great piece here. And It's funny because it seems like they didn't even need to do this, but it's just kind of the ritual, part of the American tradition. If you're going to have to, if you're going to launch a war, you have to make up something not true in order to justify it. Same as Libya. No one even cared whether they had a fake casus belli for Libya or not, but they came up with one just to make sure. And so in this case, it's the Khorasan group. And I had Phil Giraldi, the former CIA officer, on the show. I forget what, last Friday or something, saying, yeah. Don't let them scare you with this. It's just Al-Qaeda. Same old Al-Nusra front as always. You and Glenn have this great breakdown of, geez, it really is. It's like the Gulf of Tonkin incident or something like this, where, they put out this fake story, although it sure fell apart a lot faster than the Gulf of Tonkin story did. But you guys just have a great breakdown of, how the government leaked this story, who they leaked it to, their pets and sock puppets in the American media who beat us all over the head with us, and then how it all fell apart in just a matter of a couple of days here. So I guess, first of all, can you start with the AP story and what was behind that?
Right. So on September 13th, AP reported a story through Ken Delanian about this group, the Khorasan group, which is apparently plotting or said to be plotting attacks against the U.S. homeland. That came out on the 13th, and it was the first mention anyone had really heard of the Khorasan group. People who followed the issue in Syria very closely had not heard of it, and most Syrians on the ground who were interviewed had never heard of it either. Well, all Syrians who spoke to the media, actually. So it was kind of surprising when this narrative came up, and then in the weeks building up to the strike, you saw more official statements saying that, you know, there's a specific threat and details about that threat, which ostensibly involved attacks against airliners, toothpaste bombs, explosive clothing. And, you know, this kind of built up to crescendo in the media where you saw mainstream media and NBC talking about this quite a lot, CNN all building up the hype of this group. And then the strikes happened, and then you saw, you know, the results. There were statements saying the Khorasan group has been scattered and so forth. And then after that, immediately after that, the people who had been leaking these statements or making them in public immediately, you know, walked back all their previous claims about the threat that this group posed. First they said that, well, you know, there wasn't an imminent threat. Then they said any plan that we discussed, you know, may have just been aspirational, quote unquote. And then they said that the Khorasan group does not really exist in the sense that there's no group of people in Syria who call themselves the Khorasan group. It's just a name that we gave them to denote the people we wanted to attack. So the entire narrative of the threats and the reason for a war which had to be launched without congressional authorization, it just kind of collapsed on its own. It wasn't even that people picked it apart. The government just, you know, they pulled back their own claims.
Right. Well, and I guess, you know, the pressure was on in this day and age with Twitter and all this kind of thing, and where someone who's a serious journalist but maybe is a little bit, you know, marginal, like Shane Harris over there at foreignpolicy.com, official as can be, but obviously not a big host on CBS. But then again, once he starts to raise doubts, well, that goes out on Twitter where everybody can see it. And once people, you know, journalists in Syria start saying no one around here has ever heard of the Khorasan group, that kind of stuff, you know, it races around the world so quickly now. You can see why they tried to race to go ahead and back down from it. But you know, it's just, it's funny, it just goes to show, though, they were able to get away with it for, what, 2 or 3 days anyway. And as you say, they really, once the AP story came out, CBS and everyone else really picked it up and really beat everybody over the head with it really hard for a few days there. All the Today Show, all the morning shows, and all the terrorism experts being paraded across Fox News and everything. And they really made it sound like, yeah, these guys were going to attack our airplanes. Like, remember that one time, you know, here, not way over there.
Right, exactly. They brought out all the agitprop that they usually do to, you know, build up the emotional response, like the graphics and the terrorism experts with their hypotheses of what could happen. And it's very effective in building consensus for these kind of things because, you know, as much as I think that when you get your news primarily from written sources or even Twitter or publications such as Foreign Policy, you end up having more nuance than the other sources. Like cable news, there's not really any space for debate or questioning it. It's more just giving you the information right there and you have to kind of absorb it. So I think that people, you know, the media played a very crucial role, as they have in the past, in building consensus to these strikes and helping build up sufficient hysteria But then they didn't do the role of a journalist, which is to, you know, express skepticism about the claims before reporting them.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole thing of it. They can hide behind the excuse that it's just objective news. It's a fact that officials say this. Yeah, but they could just as easy phrase it that, well, officials claim this, but we haven't seen any evidence of it yet, which would be honest and entirely different than the way that they come across. As you said, the words I was looking for, you nailed it, the graphics, right? The plane in the background, the new enemy in the square over Brian Williams' shoulder and all that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, it's basically, I would not say it's propaganda per se, but it's in a way functions similarly in the sense that the government can launder statements through media who are compliant. So they can say, like you said, government official statement said this. And if you don't caveat it with, you know, there's no evidence and there's no, it's just a claim and just report as is, you have government claims essentially, which are being reported through the media. And it's functioning as a mouthpiece for certain people in the government, and that's not what journalism should do. It's not what it's supposed to do in a democracy.
And now, it seems kind of strange that they decided to hit the UNLSR front. Was, after all this washed out, was there any reason left to believe that whoever these guys were, whether they were friends of Zawahiri or Baghdadi or whoever, that they were actually plotting an attack on the United States, or was the whole thing just a hoax?
So today there was some reports from Jinan Musa, who's a correspondent in the Middle East, and she visited the site where the actual airstrikes happened, one of the sites that happened, and she went through some of the debris, and they found some documents in that site regarding who these people were. And it's not the full list of people who were hit in the attack, but about 14 names they found, which were part of al-Nusra Front and part of a special unit of al-Nusra Front called the Wolf Brigade. So as far as I can determine, the United States probably wanted to target this aspect of this contingent of the Nusra Front, but they didn't want to declare war on the Nusra Front per se, because it's very popular among the Syrian opposition, because it's a very effective opposition front fighting against Bashar Assad. Yeah. So it looks like the people who killed were Wolf Brigade individuals who may or may not have had traveled from Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is how they got the Khorasan name. But it looks like they're going after Nusra Front. But there was nothing in these documents that pertained to anything related to the United States. It seems to all be doing pertain to their activities within Syria against Bashar Assad. Mm-hmm. So the claim of what was going on is not to substantiate, but we have more details as to who these people were exactly.
Right, yeah. And again, the al-Nusra Front. And of course, al-Nusra is still sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and though they haven't focused on attempting to attack the United States yet, his theory apparently still is that the U.S., the far enemy, is still a primary target. So it's still within the realm of possibility. But as they admitted, well, you know, we're thinking maybe they had talked about it before. It was aspirational rather than operational. That's becoming a cliche now. That giant lie we told you. Yeah, it was more aspirational than operational, they say. And just a quick point of fact, when you say Wolf Brigade, people shouldn't be confused about Donald Rumsfeld's old Wolf Brigade or Abadi's Wolf Brigade, which is a subset of the Shiite Badr Brigade militia, a.k.a. the Iraqi army, which would be an entirely different force here. So I wouldn't want people to get that confused. But please hold the line right there. Murtaza will be right back after this break, everybody, with Murtaza Hussein, writing at The Intercept, firstlook.org/The Intercept, the fake terror threat used to justify bombing Syria. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014, at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. Oh, my goodness. Welcome back to the show, y'all. Joe Cirincione just wrote a thing scaremongering about ISIS getting their hands on nukes. What? Yeah, Joe Cirincione, who debunked the lies about Iran's nuclear program for a decade straight now. Scaremongering about ISIS. Give me a break. Bunch of suicide bombers are going to make atom bombs, huh? All right. Speaking of suicide attacks, yeah, they attacked a school full of kids this morning in Syria. I'm on the line with Murtaza Hussein from The Intercept, and he's got this great piece with Glenn Greenwald, The Fake Terror Threat Used to Justify Bombing Syria. And it's really important that you guys get this article, read it thoroughly, pass it around on your social media, whatever. Make sure everybody sees this, because it's not just that they debunk the lie, it's that they really go through point by point which media sources took these, leaks from the government, published them as though it was gospel, and tried to convince everybody it's true, basically, as a propaganda effort. And then who, you know, went to work debunking it, and the government officials who admitted that it was overblown and all of that. It's very well put together, very important. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about here is what you say about the sources and how they really, I think this really reads in Greenwald's voice here about the way that they spun it was as though this was the result of some hardcore investigative journalism where they worked really hard to pry these secrets loose from these government officials, when really they're just stenographers for anonymous liars.
Right, absolutely. And it's kind of funny because they're acting as though, you know, the name is so secret that we can't even reveal it. But it's because the name is just made up, and they had not done any due diligence or expressed any skepticism about these claims. They just kind of regurgitated them and packaged it as well as some sort of hard-hitting investigative journalism. So, you know, when people within the government are leaking information, you have to be cognizant of the fact that they are likely, in many cases, doing it for their own benefit in some sense, or to further certain policy ambitions. It's not that the fact that you have another leaker who's giving you the inside scoop on a story. You have to express skepticism, and you have to look at what the possible motives are for releasing this information. So, you know, it was released, and then it came out, and then, you know, just as quickly as it was released, the whole thing came apart, and then the people involved, you know, if there was accountability, they would look foolish, but I don't think there will be. So it's just the cycle repeating itself again.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the crazy part here. There's just absolutely no accountability, even in the media. I mean, we all know better than to think there'd be accountability in government. But in the media, you would think, for example, this guy, Ken Delanian, is that how you say it? The AP reporter here, he was only just, you would have thought, completely and wholly disgraced right out of the business a couple of weeks ago when Ken Silverstein, formerly of Harper's and now with you guys at The Intercept, outed him as being the Western Hemisphere's greatest tool of the CIA when it comes to publishing the news.
Right, absolutely. But of course, that didn't happen. It just kind of, you know, things kind of continued rolling on. Everyone brushed it off. And then, you know, he took part in a story which was every bit as big, and he repeated the same process again. So there's just not a meritocracy, and there's not any sort of accountability for journalistic malfeasance. And I don't think any of the mainstream journalists who put this on TV and reported on something in such a hyperbolic way that turned out to be not to be true, I'd be very skeptical if they suffer any consequences for it or even be forced to reflect on it. There's just no memory and there's no accountability, as I said. And it's just going to, it will ensure that this will happen again.
Yeah. You know, Robert Perry one time on the show got all philosophical talking about the old days when there used to be these kind of tough old guys in fedoras and trench coats who would have absolutely laughed and ridiculed somebody like this Ken Delanian right out of the business. He would have not lasted a day, certainly not after it being revealed that he checks all of his stories with the CIA before he publishes them, et cetera, like in that Ken Silverstein piece, that there would have been, if not from his bosses, just from the peer pressure from the other journalists, he would have been considered, you know, lower than a Soviet stooge, and out the door you go. Your writing career is over. Go pick up garbage or something. But no, in America now, post Iraq war, WMD scam, any reporter can tell any lie as long as it's the one the government wants, and there's no accountability whatsoever. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's stunning, and it's just become completely the collegiality, quote-unquote, between journalists and between the government has become so great that, yeah, the one thing you can get in trouble for is if you express skepticism about government claims and you appear unpatriotic. But if you just lie, err on the side of lying or err on the side of believing everything the government says is true, even if you're wrong, it turns out that you've been spun for a lie, there's not really much accountability or criticism for that. It's just considered part of the business.
Yep. Yeah, my friend Shauna said back during the lies about the Iraq war back in 2002 that it seemed like their MO really was, they really don't care if Murtaza Hussein or anyone else debunks their lie tomorrow. All they care about is that they can get away with getting it out there on the nightly news without being challenged tonight. And as long as they can get you to believe it for a day, they can do that terrible thing they were trying to do, which was why they were lying in the first place. And then everybody already knows they're liars anyway. So the fact that it goes on their reputation that they lied one more time doesn't really matter. They don't really care. They just keep on lying as long as they can get you to believe it for a day, even half a day sometimes. Good enough for them.
Exactly. And in this case, you know, they just needed a few days to conduct their strikes. And then when next time it has to happen again, they'll repeat the cycle again, and it probably will work.
Yep. And then back to the reason why it was so important that they come up with this separate name for what was in essence just Al-Qaeda in Syria, the Al-Nusra Front, was because, according to Roy Gutman, who I think was on the ground in Turkey at the time, writing for McClatchy Newspapers, he was saying, I think you kind of referenced this earlier too, that the Al-Nusra Front is really popular. And so the Pentagon or the CIA or whoever decided it was important enough, they wanted to hit this target, but they did not want to go to war with Nusra. They want to keep the war against ISIS and their biggest enemy, Assad, but leave Nusra alone, even though they're the ones who are loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri. And so that was why they made up the name Khorasan, even though, what the hell? It's not like the locals read the AP and would be fooled by a leak to the AP anyway. They just, you know what I mean? They know that it was al-Nusra that got bombed. They are there. They're the al-Nusra sympathizers we're talking about.
Exactly. So that just makes the whole thing more puzzling, because I'm sure the American people would not have been so galled by the fact that they were striking al-Qaeda, and it certainly was not going to fool Syrians. So what was the intention of this obfuscation which happened? And I think part of it is to do with the fact that, you know, we've kind of, quote-unquote, declared victory over al-Qaeda many times over the last several years because it was politically expedient to do so. And if we have to announce that we're still, you know, attacking al-Qaeda operatives and they're still a threat to us directly, then it says, well, what the hell have you been doing for the last 13 years? Why have you made no progress in this issue, or so little progress that we're still, you know, facing a mortal danger from this group? Right. So I think that may have been part of the motivation as well, right, to simply shape the domestic discussion about it. So no, their adversaries cannot say, well, why is the battle against al-Qaeda, you know, why are you losing it, or why is it still menacing us if we've committed so much time and resources to it?
Right. Yeah, well, and you know, Obama actually rightly has said, listen, every time a Sunni with a rifle declares a jihad somewhere and declares that they're loyal to al-Qaeda somewhere, we're not going to be foolish enough to go racing. You know, he's learned that lesson. He's not really changed his policy that much. Well, kind of. I mean, look at Libya and Mali. He didn't go racing headlong into there chasing after his consequences. Not yet, anyway. So he's smart to say that, but then at the same time, he's been helping, and America's satellite states have been helping make the Mujahideen war in Syria a much bigger deal than it would have been on its own. And so it's really hard to, especially at this point, but even for the last couple of years, it's been really pretty much a lie to say, oh, don't worry, this isn't al-Qaeda, this isn't a big deal, this is just another local little insurgency that we're going to try to ignore, because they've made it humongous.
Right, they have made it humongous. And the point you made about, you know, anyone who just seemingly declares allegiance to al-Qaeda, it's a bit more complicated in some senses, because a lot of Nusra people, well, some reporters on the ground have suggested they have never, although they're nominally associated with Nusra, it's more so out of Nusra's effectiveness at fighting the government of Bashar Assad. And the vast majority of them don't necessarily have contact with al-Qaeda Central, even though theoretically they've given allegiance to them. So it's complicated, and I think this is another reason why they wanted to sort of designate this Wolf Brigade / Khorasan group as their enemy, although no one's going to buy that for many reasons, because they wanted to have some token differentiation. But again, how effective that will be, it's hard to say.
Right. Well, we just need to train up the right moderates, and everything will be fine, I think.
Yeah, of course, as always.
All right. Hey, listen, thanks very much for your time on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. That's Murtaza Hussein. He's writing for The Intercept at firstlook.org/The Intercept. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. I mean, god dang. I don't like being lied to. That's the thing. And Joe Cirincione, you know, I like Joe because he's against war with Iran and he's always, not always. He's mostly been pretty good at debunking nuclear weapons hype about Iran. But he just sounds like Frank Gaffney here. Which, speaking of Gaffney, there's a thing today in Salon.com about how he's backed by the military-industrial complex, according to Eli Clifton, who has also documented in the past the ties between the Israel lobby and especially the very lowest scum of the neoconservative movement, like Frank Gaffney and their efforts, their network behind the more kind of base, targeted at rednecks sort of Islamophobia movement in America. It's a very top-down thing run by pro-Israel Likudniks in New York City. And what they do is try to get you to hate and fear all Muslims, because that's good for Israel, because all their enemies are Muslims, and because that's who they're stealing land from mostly, and Christians, but they don't ever tell you that, so you don't have to worry about that. But anyway, hey, wait a minute. That's a trivia question for American conservatives there. Is a Palestinian a full-fledged human being with a natural right to life and maybe even to own property if they're Christian? Does that make them 51% of a man? Huh? Pop quiz, conservatives. Are Palestinians human if they're Christian Palestinians? Oh, I know that the Israelis have ethnically cleansed almost all of the Palestinian Christians out of the West Bank, but there's still some. Anyway. Point being, war propaganda about deadly weapons of mass destruction. Weapons of mass destruction. First of all, weapons of mass destruction is a giant lie right to your face in the first place. Weapons of mass destruction is an attempt to conflate a canister of mustard gas with an atom bomb that can kill hundreds of thousands, maybe more, in an instant. You know, the bomb that killed Hiroshima was 10 kilotons. The bomb that killed Nagasaki was like 30 kilotons, something like that. They have bombs that are 30 megatons now that could kill Houston, Texas, which last I checked, which was a long time ago, was the fifth biggest city in the world. Something like that. Way huge and spread out, too. You could kill Houston with an H-bomb. Even with an atom bomb, you could get them up to, you know, tens and tens of kilotons now. So to conflate some definitely would-be botched attempt at a real biological attack, which is so difficult to make work, is just basically don't worry about it. You can just, you know, that's not hardly even an issue at all. And then chemical weapons with nukes. So, WMD threat is deliberately vague. It's what the advertising people call glittering generalities. Go ahead and be scared, we said. We'll tell you why later. And you know what? You know, as long as I'm insulting conservatives and their intelligence, it was going around the other week. Oh, my God. It turns out George W. Bush was right about Saddam's weapons all along. Like, God, why don't you just scream, I'm a freaking idiot. My first thing I do is I repeat whatever I like without checking at all. Yes, ISIS seized a facility that once had been used to make chemical weapons back in the era when Saddam Hussein worked for Ronald Reagan. But none of it was secret, and none of it was hidden of that facility. None of that was hidden from the United Nations ever. That wasn't even hidden for a couple of months. And some of the chemical weapons were hidden for a couple of months after the first Gulf War, but were all destroyed by the end of 2001, or all at least declared to the international inspectors by the end of 1991. The fact that that factory was still sitting there, and that maybe even canisters of chemical weapon precursors whose shelf life expired 30 years ago were sitting there. Sorry, conservatives, and your beliefs, doesn't mean that George Bush was right at all. They also had a stockpile of uranium that was sitting there under IAEA lock and key, open and declared to all international inspectors and locked up by the international inspectors. They just hadn't moved it out of the country yet. The accusation against Saddam was not he has a bunch of stuff left over that he's already confessed to that we haven't finished getting rid of yet, that is all worthless, that he can't do anything with anyway. That wasn't the accusation. The accusation was he had storehouses full of VX, sarin, anthrax, getting into the biological weapons, and mustard gas, warehouses full, that he had trucks, 18-wheeler trucks that were mobile biological weapons labs. Why, look, Colin Powell has a cartoon of what one might look like if it wasn't Iranian disinformation laundered through Ahmed Chalabi and his merry men to lie the pro-Likudniks into war with Iraq under the pretense that it'd be good for Israel instead of good for Iran. But no, boy, what's the definition of a conservative? The definition of a conservative is someone who, when he gets a thing in his email that says, oh my God, they found a chemical in Iraq and it proves George Bush was right, he hits forward, send. Unable to rub even two brain cells together. Wow, a gigantic factory full of stuff, and George Bush couldn't find it in 8 years of occupying the country, but ISIS just found it, huh? Wow, you guys are really smart. I'd have let you write my kid's science textbook, I hear the people saying. You idiots. Anyway, sorry, I'm off on a tangent again. Joe Cirincione has come up with a conservative level argument about ISIS and nuclear weapons. Are you ready for this stupidity? Quote, if ISIS could make the right connection to corrupt officials in Russia or Pakistan, why then the group might be able to buy enough highly enriched uranium and the technical help to build a crude nuclear device. Militants recruited from Europe or America could help smuggle it into their home nations. Wow, Joe! You just scared the crap out of me, dude! That's a lot of coulds, buddy. Yes, you see, if Vladimir Putin handed a ready-made hydrogen bomb to Joe Cirincione, then Joe Cirincione could pose a nuclear threat to Cincinnati, because all he would have to do is drive it from D.C. to Cincinnati, and then he could blow it up, dude. Oh! Are you kidding me? You actually wrote that with your fingers and hit send? Are you kidding me? Now listen, Gordon Prather, an actual nuclear scientist, an actual former nuclear physicist, currently physicist, but a former nuclear weapons designer and former chief scientist of the Army. He always said that Joe Cirincione doesn't know anything and is an absolute stupid idiot. And the fact that he constantly, after years and years and years on end of being corrected, continues to call MI6, M16, just, he shouldn't be taken seriously at all, even when he's right about something. And in fact, I haven't taken him seriously at all, even when he's right about something, for a long time. Go back and check the records. You'll see I haven't interviewed him since God knows when, 2007 or 8. because the guy's kind of an idiot. Anybody who calls MI6 M16 more than, you know, twice when they first hear of it when they're a teenager, you know, isn't all that smart, really. And so that's his slippery slope. If someone gave a nuke to ISIS, then they'd have one. And if they could deliver it somewhere, then they could deliver it somewhere. Jesus Christ, Joe. Have a little self-respect. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, so listen, more on this. Cerencione is just making a ridiculous argument when he says here, if someone, he doesn't even say the governments, if a corrupt official stole a nuke from Russia or Pakistan and sold it to ISIS, then they'd have one. And then if they could deliver it to America, then they could deliver it to America. Huh? All right, well, never mind that. What about the idea that, hey, the Islamic State, say nobody stops them, and they exist for 5 years or something, they become an actual real state in the world. What would it take for them to make nuclear weapons? First of all, I don't know if there's any indigenous uranium sources in Iraq, but it would be a huge project for them to try to dig some up. The stuff that had been declared and was sitting around in Iraq, all that has been moved out of the country. The nuclear material has been moved out of the country during the American occupation. So they would have to buy uranium on the world market, which they cannot do because there is no world market in uranium other than controlled by the nuclear suppliers group and the American Empire, basically. That was why they had to come up with this, oh, Saddam's buying uranium from Niger. They couldn't say, oh, he's going to use the uranium that's under IAEA lock and key in his country, because they would have known that that's not true. It's all sitting there under IAEA lock and key. But, and then they had to say, oh, yeah, Bush even said from Africa, because he didn't want to be so specific as to say, yeah, from Nigeria, where it's the French government owns Nigeria pretty much anyway, and they certainly own all of the uranium. And was Bush really accusing the French of selling uranium to Iraq? Well, he sure didn't accuse them of that, did he? Because then they would have said, what? You damn liar. And it would have blown up huge in his face right there off the bat. So it was a little bit easier to fudge it a little bit. But in other words, there is no world market in weapons-grade uranium or any other way for them to get it other than enriching it themselves. And what would it take for them to enrich it themselves? The Islamic State under Baghdadi? They would need magic to come up with the, or I guess they could get from Pakistan if the CIA let them, they could get from Pakistan the equipment to enrich uranium, possibly. But then you're talking about from scratch a decades long project, and that is in a stable country that's not completely and totally isolated and surrounded by enemies and at war all the time. There's, you know, in other words, in some other dimension where this Islamic State was created, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, that Saddam's nuclear program had never been dismantled in the first place and they inherited it somehow or something, then maybe. But otherwise, we're already just completely in the realm of fantasy that they could dig a Natanz-like facility in the ground and just start filling it with centrifuges and whatever, like in Iran. There's just no way. And then to enrich up to weapons-grade uranium, the hardest part. Now, to make a very simple Hiroshima-type nuke, if you have the finished weapons-grade uranium, is actually not that difficult, although it'll be big and heavy, and it would take you know, at least an airliner to be able to deliver it anywhere, certainly from Iraq. Or I guess, yeah, you could put it in the back of a flatbed truck. And Bush and Obama have given the jihadists direct access to the Levant by overthrowing Saddam Hussein and supporting the rebellion against Assad for the last few years. So I guess you got a point there. If we grant you 15 impossible things happening first, And they had the uranium. Yes, they could machine and make a simple gun type nuke and, you know, deliver it in a truck to somewhere. But, of course, that much is, you know, even getting that far is basically impossible. To build a nuke that's small enough to deliver by putting it on the head of a rocket, you need to make it an implosion nuke, which technically, theoretically could be done with uranium, but pretty much now you would need plutonium to do, other than in some special circumstances, I don't know, you need plutonium to do a miniaturized implosion system nuke. And again, back to Joe's argument, yes, if they bought ready-made equipment from the Russians, who are not selling it to the Islamic State, the Russians, who are our natural allies against the Islamic State, in fact, if they bought the material and the expertise from others who had it, then yeah. But, okay, so what? Again, if Putin handed an H-bomb to Joe Cirincione, then he'd be a nuclear bomb threat too. That isn't any less plausible than his slippery slope argument here. It's just completely ridiculous. You know, now, could they build a dirty bomb? I suppose it's possible they could get their hands on some radioactive materials from, I don't know, the University of Mosul. I'm completely making that up. I have no idea whether they had the slightest bit of nuclear material at all. Maybe somewhere in Sunnistan there's nuclear material for medical purposes, something else. They could set off a dirty bomb somewhere. But if they were going to do that, it'd be in Baghdad. That's where it would be. It would be, you know, in Sadr City. So, yeah, I don't think we need to worry about that. And still be extremely difficult for them to get their hands on anything like that. A dirty bomb, if you're not familiar, that just means it's just a bomb, but you include nuclear material so that it's extra scary for people. That, oh my God, nuclear material in the dust everywhere, that kind of thing. So it's extra terroristy, but it's not extra deadly, really. This just helps create more fear. But it has nothing to do with fission whatsoever. So anyway, yeah, Joe Cirincione, absolutely all wet here. He sounds just like Frank Gaffney, the liar, whose specialty it is to lie to the American people about Iran, which is not making nuclear weapons and which has never even had a project to make nuclear weapons. And about how, boy, if they only had one gun-type nuke, they could kill us all. And his slippery slope argument is, never mind where they get the nuke from, just magic. And then how they get it on a boat with a giant rocket, some barge with a giant rocket on it, and float that all the way across the Atlantic Ocean without anybody noticing, and then fire it from America's east coast over the center of America somehow, and then detonate this nuke in the atmosphere and turn off all of our lights forever. And then at that point, we'll all die. 90% of the American people will all die in a gigantic, you know, Great Leap Forward style famine. And Frank Gaffney will be proven right for once in his life. Yeah, Frank Gaffney claims that he used to be the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for something when he never was. It's a total lie. Frank Gaffney, complete liar. As Gordon Prather, actual expert, explained to me, if a regular fission atom bomb is close enough to you to turn out your lights, you're not going to need to worry about electricity because you're a dead man anyway. It's going to kill you here in just a moment. That's not a problem. The electromagnetic pulse comes from hydrogen bombs and especially from neutron bombs, which are basically just a kind of hydrogen bomb. It has a very thin casing on it, so that most of the energy is released as radiation rather than directly as heat, because they don't hold the chain reaction together as long. And so, in other words, Russia, China, Britain, or France could turn out our lights by launching many, many, many H-bombs into outer space above America. Goddamn brakes always mess me up. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. Me, I'm Scott Horton. Man, I screwed up. I was putting it off to the last second, then I realized that Trevor Tim is not online on his Skype, which means I can't call him on his Skype, which means that, well, maybe we won't have him. Maybe we'll have him later. Maybe we'll have him after a little while. Anyway, I'm sorry. I am just terrible about the hard breaks here, and they screw me up, and I don't watch the clock because I'm an idiot. So I got screwed up. What I was trying to say is, yes, there is such a thing as an electromagnetic pulse from nuclear weapons that will turn off your lights. They found this out testing H-bombs in the Pacific back in the 50s. And the thing of it is this, that the way you do it is with an enhanced radiation device, a.k.a. a neutron bomb. And the real purpose of them, actually, is to turn out the lights. And then, you know, they notice that a good side effect is, wow, we could kill a lot of people with not much explosion and leave the cities intact and take over our enemies' factories and wealth and all that. And neat. Has a very Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter era kind of feel to it, doesn't it? The neutron bomb. The Russians called it the imperialist bomb because that was what it was meant to do, right? They thought, at least. That was its first purpose. Makes sense enough. Secondary purpose, anyway. We could kill all the Russians, but without completely destroying Russia. We could just make it America Junior, and once the radiation went away in 20 years or something, go and settle the place and take it for our own. But anyway, that's what it would take to turn out the lights. And why anyone should believe Frank Gaffney that no one would be able to make a circuit again after that or repair any kind of thing or whatever. Yeah, who knows? It's just nonsense. The EMP threat is just nonsense. Again, in 100 years, if Iran ever did have nuclear bombs, simple fission bombs, not even simple ones, implosion bombs, plutonium implosion bombs, they can't turn out your lights without just killing you in the explosion anyway. It takes H-bombs above the ionosphere, raining down, and it would take a lot of them to, you know, when you're talking about blowing every circuit in America, I mean, give me a break, dude. All right. I'm sorry for wasting your time on such stupidity. There's also no such thing as a suitcase nuke. The trunk of a town car? Okay, maybe. But there is no suitcase nuke. That's all just a fanciful nonsense, too. Okay. Okay, we got Trevor online here. Let me give him a call. Trevor Tim, he writes for The Guardian. He used to be over there at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and now he is with the Free Press Foundation. And, man, he's just been writing this great stuff. I was telling you before, he's just been kicking ass over here at The Guardian, where you can find his articles here. It's the Freedom of the Press Foundation at pressfreedomfoundation.com. That's the website. And here he is at The Guardian. We got, your iPhone is now encrypted. The FBI says it'll help kidnappers. Who do you believe? And Mr. President, will you tell us the truth? 8 questions we must ask Obama about secret war. Welcome back to the show. Trevor, how you been, man?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us today.
Yeah. So before we jump in, I have some great news for you because I know you've been on me every time I come on. We finally switched our URL, so it's easier to remember.
Yes,
it is freedom.press.
Freedom.press. I didn't know .press was a thing.
It wasn't a thing until about 2 weeks ago, and so we were the first to snag it. So
great. Freedom.press. What a great URL.
Yeah,
which is the exact opposite of the old situation.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, great news. And I just wrote it down, so I'll try to remember to say it at the end, too. Great. Okay, so I got the new thing on my the new software on my old iPhone here, and I kind of want to ask you about that, but I don't know. That's not really as interesting as this other stuff, and I only have you for one segment here. So I guess if you could, just talk to me for 10 minutes about your two previous ones before that, the questions, but also this Clintonite. Depends what the meaning of torture and murder is arguments about whether they're having a war or whether it's just a counterterrorism strategy and all of the just the blatant BS that they're using to get us into this thing, Trevor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the language here is, you know, I think the phrase Orwellian is often overused, but here it's truly Orwellian newspeak, where they have taken basic definitions of words that we all know the meaning of and completely changed them, and to the point where it's hard to tell what's going on and what's not. So, for example, you know, I'm sure you've covered it before, but during the drone wars in Yemen and Pakistan, they basically changed the name of civilian and or changed the definition of civilian to include that all military age males in a strike zone are effectively combatants, whether unless they are approved otherwise afterwards. So we saw this in play last week where for almost a whole week, we knew that there were casualties in the first strikes in Syria. Civilian casualties, because the Free Syrian Army, which we support, had been saying it. There was photos, there was videos, there was all sorts of reports, yet the administration wouldn't admit there were any civilian casualties. The same thing can be said for now the newest phrase is combat troops. You know, President Obama has been going on TV saying absolutely no combat troops in Iraq or Syria. That's our red line. While he's saying that, he's sending in right now, the latest number is 1,600 military advisors, quote unquote. And military advisors are really just ground troops in disguise because they can go to the front lines with their Iraqi troops. They can have weapons. They can fire on people if they're fired upon, and they can call in airstrikes. And so, you know, in the New York Times, there was this great article which basically said that virtually every military expert rejected the Obama administration's definition of combat troops.
Right. And of course, those numbers, that 1600, that excludes the Special Operations Command, that excludes the Joint Special Operations Command, which is different, and it excludes the CIA and all their Merc friends too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Anything that's covert, it is not, you know, included in these numbers. So really, we have no idea. And then there's the contractors too, who, as many people have been reporting, think that Iraq and Syria are their next big meal ticket. You know, you'll remember the contractors, most notoriously Blackwater, who were a big reason why Iraq was such a chaotic disaster just a few years ago. So, you know, the language that they are using to redefine war, I think is really disturbing and deserves a lot more attention than it's been getting.
Yeah. I wrote in 2009, right after, his first speech at Camp Lejeune in, March of 2009, a month into his presidency, I said, those who bought into the slogans Hope and Change last fall should have read the fine print. We were warned over and over. During the campaign for presidency, Barack Obama made it clear that withdrawal from Iraq on his flexible 16-month timetable meant only the removal of combat forces. He also made it clear all along that combat forces means whatever he wants it to mean until he decides to change his mind. At least he's honest. And that was the thing of it, is because he made this clear from 2007 on that, you know, we can have as many troops there as we want, and we can call them something else if we feel like it. There was no secret about it. And sorry, I shouldn't have read that whole thing, but still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and look at the word imminent, which has now lost all meaning. Because, you know, when President Obama was running for presidency the first time, he said that it would be unconstitutional for the president to enter into airstrikes or war with the country if there wasn't an imminent threat to the United States. And so now we have a situation where all of the intelligence agencies are widely reporting that ISIS is not an imminent threat to the United States. You know, they may be barbaric and horrible and just, you know, a terrible, terrible influence in that region, but they are not actively planning attacks inside the United States, at least according to the FBI, the DNI, and Department of Homeland Security. Yet here we are going to war, in a situation where it's not actually imminent. And you know, they've just changed that definition too to mean, you know, anything they want, essentially, you know, removing all sorts of checks and balances they used to have.
Oh, hey, Trevor, is there any way you can stay one more 7 minutes, or you really got to go?
No, actually, I'm good. We can do one more if you want.
Okay, good deal. Hang tight right there. We'll be right back, y'all. Thanks. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. We're talking about Barack Clinton, our president, the definition of is. Fighting age males means you can kill them. They're militants. Imminent means, it could be at some point, maybe. Troops excludes everybody who's over there. Rangers, spies, Delta guys, SEALs, whatever. Marines. Brand new Marine contingent landing in Kuwait right now, getting ready for a couple of weeks from now. And then, another thing that they keep lying to us about here, Trevor, is, that we just covered it with Murtaza Hussein about the attacks on the so-called Khorasan unit, which is just Al-Qaeda in Syria, the al-Nusra front that they were bombing. But they lied about it, one, to not anger our friends who are big fans and friends with the Nusra front, but we're trying to recruit as our moderate third force in Syria. And that's a pretty damn big lie, this moderate third force, that they're going to create some army of 5,000 guys who are, volunteers to fight in this thing, to kill people in this thing, but who only want to kill ISIS, Nusra, and Assad, and work for America, and they're going to train them for a year. And then, look, everybody in D.C. and New York and on Twitter and everywhere is just laughing at this. Everybody knows it's completely ridiculous. No one's even taking it seriously at all. And yet, it's the stated plan for moving forward into with the airstrikes in Syria and the further intervention in Syria. Not that I would recommend it. I think it'd be absolutely horrible and blow up in our face and all kinds of other objections. But under their logic, at least, it would make sense for the American government to really with Assad like George W. Bush and Bill Clinton did and help him kill jihadis. But no, they can't do that because of the politics of Israel and Saudi and Qatar, too, I guess. And so, the moderates, we're supporting the moderates, which everybody who knows about this agrees. If there's any moderates at all, it's just because they're more criminals than they are Islamists. But they're certainly not nice guys, and they're certainly not any kind of force that even could be created there, much less already exists to ally with. How's that for lying us into war?
Yeah, the situation is just so unbelievably complicated. It's just hard to see how it could ever turn out well, even if everything that the administration says will happen, which again is almost impossible. So, we have here this Free Syrian Army that's supposedly moderate, but which many people say isn't, which are openly aligned with the Nusra Front, which is basically Al-Qaeda. So we're essentially training, right now we're training fighters who are openly aligned with the terrorists we say that we're at war with in other countries. And they want to fight Assad and are now completely pissed at the United States, openly so. There's a report in McClatchy just a couple days ago about how there was thousands of people protesting in the streets over U.S. Strikes because they're not going after the people that the rebels want to go after, and that they are trying to focus on ISIS, and they're also killing people that they think are allies. And, it's just a disaster. And then, meanwhile, one of the questions that I said that people should be asking President Obama was the fact that we've actually been training and arming the Syrian Free Syrian Army for over a year now. We have this debate in Congress about whether we should fund them, whether we shouldn't. We already have been, except it's been covert. It's an open secret that the CIA has been training and arming them for a year. It's been printed in virtually every major newspaper. But when Congressman asked Secretary of State John Kerry about it, he said that he couldn't confirm or deny that it actually happened. So maybe we should go back and look at whether it's worked for the last year to give them a bunch of arms and whether we should continue to do so, not whether we should do so from the start, because we know that all of these arms, or not all of them, but a lot of them have actually ended up in ISIS's hands. So it's already backfiring. Yet we seem to want to ignore that evidence and go full steam ahead right into Syria again.
Mm-hmm. You know, someone pointed out in an article I think we'll be running on antiwar.com tomorrow that the Buck McKeon Amendment to fund the arming and the training of the Syrian rebels even has a provision that the military or whoever, CIA or whoever, I guess, the military in charge, they are to keep Congress up to date on the green-on-blue attacks, which they anticipate are guaranteed to result from this. They're going to take a bunch of FSA guys to Saudi Arabia. The moment they give them live ammo, one of these guys who's actually more loyal to the Islamic State or to Golani and the al-Nusra Front is going to turn on his American trainers, turn on his fellows and shoot them. And so Congress is anticipating this. The hawks are anticipating this and are saying, oh, make sure to keep us up to date on how that develops, the insider attacks. The fraggings, yeah, that's what they used to call it, fraggings, for people confused about what the hell I'm talking about, all this jargon.
They're also basically admitting that by attacking, you know, going to war against ISIS, we're actually increasing our chances for a terrorist attack at home. You know, as soon as we started bombing them, there was all sorts of alerts from DHS and FBI saying, you know, be on the lookout for retaliation attacks or lone wolf attacks now that the U.S. is in war again. And so, you know, the very problem that we're supposedly trying to solve, we're actually just increasing by doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you say, and like in the previous interview with Murtaza Hussein about the Khorasan thing, it's all based on dishonesty and a complete and total lack of accountability for everybody who either lies in the first place or, you know, fails to call out the liars in the media who parrot this stuff and help it continue. I mean, ever had to try to shoot it straight to the American people about who's on whose side in Syria, they would have to just throw up their hands and say, boy, it shouldn't be us on any side here.
I mean, the Khorasan thing is another example of them just twisting the English language so that they can somehow justify the legality of all of this. You know, nobody in America knew what the Khorasan group was 3 weeks ago. All of a sudden, these classified leaks started about a week before the strikes. And then, you know, the morning after the strikes, all of a sudden the U.S. was saying that the Khorasan group was planning an imminent attack on the U.S. Again, a legal word which they use, which can justify airstrikes. But then, you know, we found out a couple of days later it wasn't so imminent after all, that a bunch of U.S. officials were saying that it was aspirational, that, you know, the U.S. wasn't sure if it was an actual plan that was operational or that there was any time frame involved. So, you know, here we have them taking a word that is supposed to mean, you know, something in a legal sense and completely distorting it so that they can basically use it as a means to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here again, they're at war with ISIS, which has actually not ever attacked the United States, as embarrassing as it is that you got bin Laden reincarnate standing up there on the balcony in Mosul declaring himself the caliph and everything. They've actually never attacked the United States, but the al-Nusra Front is, you know, if Zawahiri was the leader of a state, they're sworn loyal to him, and he's the butcher of New York. The al-Nusra Front guys are the al-Qaeda guys in Syria. And here, the whole reason they're calling it part of the reason, at least, they're calling it Khorasan is so that it's deniable that they're at war with Nusra. As you said, because everybody starts protesting and getting all mad because they like al-Nusra. And they don't want us bombing al-Nusra. They only want us bombing ISIS and Assad. And so, here they're actually like laying off al-Qaeda or trying to, well, we got to get these few guys, but we don't want to pick a fight with the rest of al-Qaeda because we're too busy focused on ISIS and Assad. It's crazy. Again, if they had to be honest about any of it, they wouldn't be able to pursue it in this fashion.
Well, that's the problem. I mean, you know, think about how they're using their legal justification for this. They are literally arguing that the Iraq war resolution gives them the authority to bomb Syria. I mean, if you can twist a resolution to bomb one country from 12 years ago to mean that you can bomb another country now, you can pretty much do anything with English language. And, you know, It's also a failure of Congress. You know, we're blaming the president for a lot of this, and rightfully so, but Congress has been absolutely terrified to live up to its constitutional obligations to actually vote on this war and to provide some oversight. You know, they literally left the Capitol a week early than they were supposed to, basically fled out of D.C. so they could go back and campaign, and so they wouldn't have a controversial vote on their record for the election. And it's shameful that, you know, they are just going to take their sweet time for such an issue that they claim is so important to the U.S. that this is the greatest threat we've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're so dishonest about it. Boehner's saying, well, I'll have a vote on it if the president will ask for one. What? And then, like you say about the Iraq resolution, they also invoked the AUMF of 01, and they invoked the War Powers Act, and they invoked that whole imminent doctrine. And in other words, they got 10 excuses, and they know none of them are any good, so they try to use all of them to add up to one good excuse for running roughshod right over the Constitution in front of everybody.
Yep. You know, it's, you know, hopefully public pressure can change things, but, you know, the Congress and the executive branch have been spending 2 months working everybody up into a frenzy that, you know, ISIS is now the new Hitler, and that there's, you know, if we don't do anything, everybody's going to die. And, you know, it would be nice if there was a little more nuance in these debates and that we can talk about the, you know, positives and negatives of going to war yet again in the Middle East, and that, you know, a lot of times this stuff backfires, which it already is, which nobody's asking. And, you know, I guess we'll just have to wait and see, but it doesn't look good right now.
Yeah. Well, I absolutely agree with that. Even though I'm 1,000% peacenik and non-interventionist, I'm not afraid of the whole truth at all. I think the whole truth is an argument for peace and non-intervention in 1,000 different ways. So, you know, I think that's why they got to lie all the time, so they can do the wrong thing. So anyway, thanks very much. I'm sorry for talking so much instead of asking you great questions, but you're really good anyway, Trevor. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
All right, y'all. That's the great Trevor Tim. He's at freedom.press. Isn't that great? Freedom.press. That's it. Not freedom.press.something.com. Just freedom.press. The Freedom of the Press Foundation. And where he's sits on the board of directors there with Greenwald, with Snowden, with Daniel Ellsberg. I mean, give me a break. Freedom.press. And then also he's at The Guardian. Mr. President, will you tell us the truth? 8 questions we must ask Obama about secret war. We'll be right back. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, you can go back to... Let's go back here. I'm sorry, I should think of all this stuff during the break instead of right at the moment when I'm coming back from the break. Now, the antiwar.com version is called Washington's Secret Wars, but the American Conservative version is better. Giraldi, and this would have been 2011, Syria, I forget the title of the damn thing. Nope, that was it. NATO versus Syria. And this is from December 19th, 2011. And of course, Phil's written a lot about this since then. But this is about America and our NATO allies in Turkey and France, especially intervening on the side of the rebels in the Syrian war. And he says here, French and British special forces trainers are on the ground assisting the Syrian rebels while the CIA and U.S. special ops are providing communications equipment and intelligence to assist the rebel cause, enabling the fighters to avoid concentrations of Syrian soldiers. CIA analysts are skeptical regarding the march to war. That's why they're ratting on Barack Obama to Phil Giraldi. Hell, this is pretty short. I'm going to read the whole thing here. Americans should be concerned about what is happening in Syria, if only because it threatens to become another... This is December 2011. Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer, friend of the show, obviously advertiser on the show, counsel for the national interest, writer for the American Conservative. Americans should be concerned about what is happening in Syria, if only because it threatens to become another undeclared war like Libya, but much, much worse. Calls for regime change have come from Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who several weeks ago predicted a civil war. That is indeed likely if the largely secular and nationalist regime of Bashar al-Assad falls, pitting Sunni against Shia and against Alawite. Indigenous Christians will be caught in the meat grinder. Ironically, many of the Christians in Damascus are Iraqis who experienced the last round of liberation in their own country and had to flee for their lives. Damn right. I'm glad I started reading this whole thing, in fact. NATO is already clandestinely engaged in the Syrian conflict, with Turkey taking the lead as U.S. proxy. Ankara's Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu. Hey, I'm doing the best I can here. I'm a Texan, all right? Has openly admitted that his country is prepared to invade as soon as there is an agreement among the Western allies to do so. The intervention would be based on humanitarian principles to defend the civilian population based on the responsibility to protect doctrine that was invoked to justify Libya. Turkish sources suggest the intervention would start with the creation of a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border and then be expanded. Aleppo, Syria's largest and most cosmopolitan city, would be the crown jewel targeted by liberation forces. Unmarked NATO warplanes are arriving at Turkish military bases close to Iskerdum on the Syrian border, delivering weapons from the late Muammar Gaddafi's arsenals. December 2011. Former CIA officer Phil Giraldi reporting in the American Conservative magazine. Unmarked NATO warplanes are arriving. NATO warplanes are arriving at Turkish military bases close to Iskenderun on the Syrian border, delivering weapons from the late Muammar Gaddafi's arsenals, as well as volunteers from the Libyan Transitional National Council, who are experienced in pitting local volunteers against trained soldiers, a skill they acquired confronting Gaddafi's army. Iskenderun is also the seat of the Free Syrian Army, the armed wing of the Syrian National Council. Those are the former sock puppets of Hillary Clinton who fell apart, the National Council there. French and British Special Forces trainers are on the ground, assisting the Syrian rebels, while the CIA and U.S. Special Ops are providing communications equipment and intelligence to assist the rebel cause, enabling the fighters to avoid concentrations of Syrian soldiers. CIA analysts are skeptical regarding the march to war. The frequently cited UN report that more than 3,500 civilians have been killed by Assad soldiers is based largely on rebel sources and is uncorroborated. Boy, it's a hell of a lot more than that by now. And the agency has refused to sign off on the claims. Likewise, accounts of mass defections from the Syrian army and pitched battles between deserters and loyal soldiers appear to be a fabrication, with few defections being confirmed independently. Syrian government claims it is being assaulted by rebels who are armed, trained, and financed by foreign governments are more true than false. In the United States, many friends of Israel are on the Assad regime change bandwagon, believing that a weakened Syria, divided by civil war, will present no threat to Tel Aviv. But they should think again, as these developments have a way of turning on their head. The best organized and funded opposition political movement in Syria is the Muslim Brotherhood. Boy, doesn't this sound like almost antique and naive? I mean, they did not invade and do outright regime change against Assad, yet they backed down from that goal. But more like he puts it there, just weakening them, dividing the country by civil war. That's certainly been the policy. But the Muslim Brotherhood, boy, that's like quaint. That was the word I was looking for. That's quaint, like the U.S. Constitution. The Muslim Brotherhood. Those are the moderates, if you can find any, compared to al-Nusra and the Islamic State. And by the way, see, let me go back one, because I thought that there was a longer, better version at the American Conservative. I guess that was it, the 16th, yeah. So now, but wait a minute, because at antiwar.com, he said something more specific. Washington's Secret Wars is the article here at antiwar.com. And what he says here is, first sentence here. Following the widely reported Iranian government plot, which this is totally bogus and debunked at the time. We'll get back to that if you want, I don't care. following the widely reported Iranian government plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington and alarming new reports of civilian deaths in Syria, the White House has issued several findings to the intelligence community, authorizing stepped-up covert action against both Damascus and Tehran. Okay? Based on a big, fake, ridiculous FBI hoax of a plot, used car salesman from Corpus Christi entrapped. Based on this bogus plot, Barack Obama signed a finding. And a finding is a piece of paper signed by the president instructing the CIA to go ahead and do whatever they want, whether it's illegal or not. That's their job, is breaking the law. And so go ahead and do this. And they're saying here, stepped up. I'm not going to read this entire thing to you, but this one is called Washington's Secret Wars. It ran on December the 8th, 2011, by Phil Giraldi. And there have been stories from, I'm trying to remember, when was the first time I heard of training bases in Jordan? I think would have been McClatchy Newspapers in 2011. I think it was still 2011, because I remember that it had been going on for quite a while, certainly. You know, Giraldi's article was basically confirmation of what we'd already been talking about throughout that year, that it was clear that what had happened with the fall of the dictators in Tunisia and Egypt, that Hillary Clinton had decided for PR reasons they were going to try to hijack the Arab Spring and use it as a pro-American thing. And they would sacrifice Gaddafi, first of all, in order to try to look like they're on the side of the little guy, keep the Chinese out, and attempt to cover up Sarkozy's corruption and whatever other reasons were involved in getting us into that horrible thing in Libya. And then, of course, for the Israeli especially policy, but I guess the Saudis and Qataris too, to hijack the protest movement in Syria, which they did very quickly and quite obviously, to turn it into a Mujahideen war, run mostly by Prince Bandar out of Saudi Arabia against Assad. There was a guy, I'm trying to remember his name, that wrote in The Guardian in the summer of 2011 about Bandar has dispatched the Mujahideen warriors off to Syria now. Eric Margulies reported in 2011 that French special forces were there assisting with all this. So we've known about this early on. I don't have time to play the Hillary clip, but yeah, Hillary admitted that it was an al-Qaeda war in early 2012. Backed them the whole time anyway. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I was just reading in the chat room. Someone was asking me how I like pissing in the wind and all this scaremongering stuff. It sucks, man. I don't know. I wish somebody would listen. Oh, yeah, that is Suitcase Nuke. Nah, there's no such thing as that. I heard somewhere that's not true. Wouldn't it be nice if I was somewhere and people heard here that... Don't worry about that. Suitcase Nuke, EMP, things Frank Gaffney says. Come on. I used to think, when I was young and naive and decided that it would be important to do this kind of thing with my life, that... Hey, if people will believe lies all day, well, then it ought to be easy as hell to convince them the truth, right? They have access to the truth, they'll know it, and then they'll be cool after that, you know. Like, hey, they'll tell you on TV why they need to have a war. You should just go ahead and by default assume that they're probably not telling the truth. And that whatever the reasons are, aren't really good enough. Instead of going along, like the last seven times... When they were, last 20 times, when they were lying and it was terrible. I don't know. I remember before the Iraq War, I don't think anyone even made the argument because no one would even dare, you know, hear the argument from the other side. But it did kind of go without saying. It was in there somewhere in the subtext of the propaganda for war. It was in there somewhere. I guess just in, you know, raises for the troops and some of the other propaganda. I guess just in a lot of the support the troops no matter what kind of mantras, meaning support the policy. Don't you dare question why we're getting these guys killed. Support the troops. Let Bush decide what happens to them. Yeah, that's real smart. But there was a thing in there, a subtext in there, that said that you may have spent the last 20 years of your life looking at Vietnam veterans in their army jackets, standing on the side of the road, homeless and filthy and desperate with signs begging for money. It used to be that there weren't that, I mean, maybe it was the veterans who, like, invented the sign of the street corner thing first or something, I don't know. It seemed like when I was a kid, they were all Vietnam veterans. Jeez, why are there so many guys with army jackets on the side of the road with signs? Because Nixon and LBJ used them all up. That's why. They're ruined men who can't take care of themselves anymore because of what they did fighting for their country. Being supported all along by good patriotic Americans, of course. But something that they said, something they never said, but was buried in there somewhere in 2002 was, don't you worry about the troops that go fight in Iraq. That's never going to happen again. These guys are going to be so well taken care of. And even never even mind the Gulf War syndrome, right? Never even mind the fact, the Gulf War illness, that the government called a syndrome, that the government denied existed. When we know is complications from anthrax vaccines, complications from the anti-sarin antidote pills that caused brainstem nerve damage, exposure to chemical weapons at the detonation of the Kamisea chemical weapons bunker and others in southern Iraq. There and other various causes, depleted uranium, of course, various causes of terrible suffering by veterans of the quick, easy, fun, simple Operation Desert Storm, Operation Yellow Ribbon, Operation Over Vietnam Syndrome and Feel Good About Yourself Again for Killing a Bunch of People. Even after all the denial through the 1990s of that, in 2002, oh, don't you worry. Boy, I don't even want to hear any dissent. This is not going to be like that. And the veterans of the Iraq War, why, they're going to just be nothing but rich and in college and moving on to professional life of being all they can be and whatever. And then, meanwhile, I'm sorry I don't know the numbers by heart anymore. I mean, I know it's 4,500 killed and upwards of tens of thousands, almost 100,000 maimed American soldiers, I mean, in the Iraq War. And it's, you know, 5,500 something if you count all the veterans of the, you know, the dead in the Afghan War as well. But then Matthew Ho, I can't remember now if it was something that he said on this show, if it was something that he said in his Bill Moyers interview, where he rattled off the huge proportions of veterans who have post-traumatic stress, or as he put, I think it was in the Moyers interview, post-traumatic stress injuries, or just severe brain injuries from all the concussions from the roadside bombs, traumatic brain injuries. Or, as he put it, other mental injuries, meaning moral injury, meaning guilt, survivor guilt for their dead friends, victimizer guilt, whatever they call that, for following Bush and Rumsfeld's orders and going around killing people in their own country. They're a wreck. And I don't know how many I see on the side of the roads, but they're sure living under the bridges if you're reading the journalism about it. And, of course, epidemics of suicide in military ranks. And it's almost like every part of that drive to war with Iraq in 2002 was a lie. Even the parts that were only implied. Even the parts that, hell, if you're young, I guess you'll just have to trust me. That it was sort of understood that maybe you've seen some Vietnam vets on the side of the road as wrecked and ruined men for the last little while. But this isn't going to be like that. I swear it was in there. But then, of course, yeah, that wasn't true. just like all the rest of it, wasn't true. And then to look at the consequences, you know, I don't do a good enough job of keeping track of right-wing media, but I did see where Dick Cheney's over there complaining about things that Barack Obama does and says. And, of course, nobody's asking this guy follow-up questions because nobody who can interview him knows anything about it or would dare to really challenge him. But if Cheney's attitude is any indication of Bush's, which I assume it is, these guys are absolutely unaccountable even to the idea in their own mind for a moment that what they did was wrong or caused others unnecessary grief or caused a worse crisis, as they exploited the existence of a few dozen Al-Qaeda guys left after they let Osama escape as a pretext to create 10,000 more of them. Like Woodrow Wilson blaming the conservatives for not wanting to take part in the League of Nations for World War II and all the consequences of his intervention in World War I. All Dick Cheney can say is what's going on in Iraq and Syria right now is because Barack Obama did not stay in Iraq and because he didn't fund the rebellion against Assad more and sooner. What? And no one can contradict him. And I don't know about Bush. Bush is a little bit different than Cheney. It's all about social psychology with him. If the right person was talking to him, I don't know who it would have to be. But if the right person or two or three people in the room really confronted him with the consequences of what he did, I bet you could at least make him understand, not make him feel bad. But he would have to admit it was his fault.
Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Got about a half hour left here. You guys want to do calls? We did some calls last week. Worked out pretty well, I thought. If you guys are interested, call in the show, 512-271-4836. Obviously, the primary topic is the Iraq War 3. I don't know what to call it. I guess Iraq War 3. But whatever, you want to talk about Ebola or you want to talk about whatever the hell else is important in the news, I'm willing to hear you out or hear your question or comment or whatever it is. So go ahead and call in, 512-271-4836. Otherwise, I got a ton of horrible news here. Well, I'm trying to get Clive Stafford Smith on the show about this, so I won't go on too long about it, but you should be aware of this article in the Daily Mail. America's deadly double-tap drone attacks are, quote, killing 49 people for every known terrorist in Pakistan, meaning, I guess, civilians. 49 civilians for every known terrorist. So we're going to interview him about that, hopefully tomorrow or the next day. More importantly, and I want to interview this guy too, Musa al-Gharibi, by hyping ISIL threat, U.S. is falling into group's trap, which of course, it benefits the U.S. state to do so. They know that. It's the same thing with al-Qaeda all along. Like I was just saying, it was just a couple of dozen guys escaped with Osama and Zawahiri out of Afghanistan in 2001 in the first place. And yet Bush and Cheney pretended like they were the USSR. Some gigantic, global caliphate that incorporated every Muslim state under their rule somehow. When, of course, finally when they tracked down bin Laden and killed him, he was hiding in the attic even from his own wives. Leave me alone, he would cry to them in Saudi dialect Arabic. But anyway, we're going to take over the whole world. That's why only we can go over there and stop them. And here, Now, Osama and George W. Bush's fantasy of the caliphate is coming to life in real life, even though it's still just no man's land, the worst part of Iraq. And I don't know too much about the land. I mean, it is the Euphrates River Valley and all that kind of thing, but sure don't have much for oil resources there. Tigris and Euphrates, yeah. I don't know as much about the geography in Syria. They do have oil in the east, but it isn't that much anyway. I told you about that Rand Corporation study where they were scaremongering about ISIS's budget, that their revenue is as much as $2 million a day. $2 million a day? Really? Because that doesn't sound like much. I'm not sure how afraid these guys are supposed to be. Oh, good. Here's a caller. Hey, you too should call in the show. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. And just in case I don't get to it, let me say one last thing, which is, I don't know if it was al-Nusra or ISIS, but they did, somebody did suicide bombings in Syria today, killed 22. It was at an elementary school. 10 children were killed. And that ain't the first time. That just goes to show what bastards these guys are. Which is why their days are numbered, no matter who intervenes or doesn't, I guess. Seems like. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, it's Corky. How you doing, man?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. Traveling today, but have one comment and then a question for you. The comment is fry some crocodile tears for the GOP because evidently their funds are way down. People are not giving them money anymore.
Oh, really?
And, you know, I'm sure that breaks your heart.
Oh, yeah, I'm all broken up. I didn't read that. Do you remember which paper you were reading that in?
It was actually a cartoon, and I can't remember who the artist was, but it was actually a picture of a Republican, I guess they're the elephants,
uh-huh.
And he was there, and there was a Tea Party guy in a torture device, and the elephant was yelling at him saying the Democratic Reds are coming, and trying to scare the Tea Party guys into giving him money, kind of thing. But
right.
Evidently, I've read this story before. This is not the first time, but
yeah.
I think a lot of people, I mean, I'm still a registered Republican, only because of Ron Paul. But, you know, I know everybody's disgusted with what's going on right now. And I'll tell you, I just hope that they come up with a decent candidate. But I know that that's probably not possible that they could do that.
Yeah, yeah. And no one listening should take any of that as an endorsement for any Democrat, but the Republicans are their own evil, not that they're that much different or even separate from the Democratic Party, such as it is. But by the way, I just Googled it, and I found an article in Politico, another one in The Hill, and another one in the National Journal backing you up that GOP fundraising is having a bad time right now. So that's good.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, they suck.
With Obama in office, you think it would be way up, and they still can't get it right. Now,
yeah,
the second
exactly.
thing I wanted to ask you about, Scott, is this whole Ebola thing. You know, I hate to say it. You know, it sounded like a conspiracy nut. It almost seems like deliberate to try to create panic and scare people into giving up their rights. I mean, I just see that. I mean, how could a guy get on a plane from an area that should be considered quarantined? I mean, I'm just... This is like I said, you know, not to belabor the point, but it's like the Three Stooges are in charge here. It's like, oh, let's put him on a plane and let him contaminate people, and then let's let him land.
Yeah, well, and then they said, I don't know if it's true or not, but they said on CNN today that the when he went to the hospital or the doctor or whoever originally saying he didn't feel good, they didn't ask him about his travel at all, and it didn't occur to him to mention to them that, you know, I was in Liberia the other day, or anything like that. So they sent him home, where he may have been able to infect more people. But, you know, as far as any kind of deliberate plan, I don't know why they would need to. You know, the fact of air travel is, and they don't have a blanket ban on air travel from West Africa right now, that he somehow snuck through a blockade or anything, you know, unexplainedly, I don't believe. So I think they just... you know, they either don't have the authority or the will or the smarts to do a good enough job. And I don't think they could. I mean, in what world are the cops going to be able to prevent disease from spreading, really? You know, I don't know. Anyway, we got real bad noise here, but thanks for the call, man. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
See ya. I think the thing is with Corky, he always calls from the beach. Sometimes we get the wind and sometimes not. But yeah, no, the Ebola thing, of course. And see, here's the thing, man. This is the beauty of being in the state is failure always wins. So it doesn't matter whether they are behind, you know, deliberately behind any particular crisis. They always benefit from crisis anyway. So, you know, Robert Higgs is the academic who says, look at this ratchet effect of increases of power, government power, every time there's a crisis, especially every time there's a war. But even, you know, hell, nowadays, every time it rains, they say, oh, you know, only we can keep you safe now, whatever. That was what Bush said was the lesson of Katrina. The lesson of Katrina is you can't just wait around for other people to do it. You got to send in the army to take command, the U.S. Army. Not the National Guard needs to be nationalized and put into use by the president or something like that. I mean, send in the U.S. Army. Anytime there's a big enough rainstorm, I think they passed that law changing the authorization of the chain of command and whatever in the event of weather crises now. Even though Bush had 10,000 authorities that he let sit there and do nothing for, you know, what, near a week and a half or something before he did a damn thing. And while, you know, of course, the local and state authorities were also, you know, botching everything as well, but still. I mean, they know that they benefit from crisis, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they create everyone. And, we got one more caller, but now we got to go out to break. So hold it right there. Anybody else wants to call in, line them up. 512-271-4836. We've got one more segment here. It's the Scott Horton Show on the Liberty Radio Network. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Anybody else wants to call in the show? It's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. I do talk too fast sometimes, don't I? Join up the chat room. I posted the number in there, too. ScottHorton.org/chat. All right, now, Corky, is this you calling back?
Hello, Scott.
Hey. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Similar number. Hey, how are you doing?
Good. I just wanted to see if you knew anything that was going on here in Canada about the lead-up to the war against ISIS and how the Prime Minister's attack dog in the House of Commons here would not answer a question from the leader of the opposition, Thomas Mulcair, about what Canada's commitment would be to the Unholy Alliance after 30 days. And the Prime Minister was not in the House. He was in New York at the at a empty room in the United Nations talking about climate change, mm-hmm. or the lack of climate change. And the deputy minister answering for the prime minister would not answer the question of the leader of the opposition and said that he was disturbed to be reading material, which I believe might have been a policy paper from the New Democratic Party here in Canada. And he would not answer the question repeatedly when asked what would happen after the 30-day commitment. And so his answer was to effect that I've read very disturbing notes about the NDP policy towards Israel. And later, at the beginning of this week, he got up in the House of Commons and made a crocodile tear apology to the House and to Leader of the Opposition, Thomas Mulcair. But I don't think it was a truly heartfelt apology. Mm-hmm. And so that is kind of the state of things here in Canada. Canadian people have not had one bit of or have not heard one bit of discussion about what sending six tired old F-18s to the Middle East will do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the only thing it'll accomplish would be a fraction of a talking point for Barack Obama that he has some legitimacy because of the international coalition. Now, okay, so remind me a couple of things. First of all, Canada did not participate in the Coalition of the Willing under George W. Bush's invasion. Did they participate in the coalition under the UN in the first Gulf War?
I don't know. That's a
That's
good,
a long time
question.
All right. So now, that's okay. But the next question is, but I'm right though that they did not participate at all in the last invasion of Iraq, correct? 2003.
Correct. But we did send our troops to Afghanistan, which, of course, you all know that that was a disastrous theater.
Right, and that under NATO, I guess, is the.
Under NATO, yes, we lost many of our fine young men in Afghanistan for no reason at all, and if their lives weren't lost, their lives were certainly ruined when they came back home, all suffering from post-traumatic stress. In fact, I know one of them who served in special forces in Afghanistan. And the stories he's told me are too barbaric to even want to think about or recount. So, he said, yeah, it was a complete disaster.
Yeah, God.
And he's a patriot, true patriot.
Yeah, of course.
But he said, no, we have no idea the culture. We have no idea how much we've inflamed that entire region, and that anything that happens now won't surprise them.
Yeah. And now this 30 days, that's basically the Canadian version of the War Powers Act, where he can go ahead without permission of the Parliament for a while. Is that it?
That's what needs to be debated. So, no, we haven't even started.
So there's not really a law that says that he can do this. He's just doing it, and then it's up to them to fight about
it. When he went to New York last week, he made this announcement that we were sending six fighters over to, I believe it's, I think they're in Qatar, I'm not sure. But
and that was the first anybody ever heard of it, you're saying?
That was the first time we had heard about it.
Yeah.
So it was a interview with a reporter, I think, from the BBC or something.
Wow. So, in other words, as per your understanding, this is he's doing just like Obama and going completely around the Canadian Constitution, the rule of law, and the way this process is supposed to work for him to be part of this war, right? Because he's not even attempting to invoke
NATO chapter. It's not so much Constitution up here. It is the House of Parliament. It's the same model that the Brits just
so
passed.
So it's an unwritten Constitution, basically.
Right. Yeah. So
they can either vote him out or not, or keep him, and that's it. You're telling me there's really no hard rules for how he has to do this, but if they don't like it, they can vote no confidence and get rid of him, but otherwise he just doesn't.
Well, he has a majority in the House, so he can pretty much do as he likes.
Yeah.
But this is definitely unprecedented, and I think it really caught a lot of people here off guard. And so you can be sure that the royal opposition, led by the New Democrats here, will definitely try and make Harper accountable for his actions.
Well, I sure hope that's true. I didn't realize you guys had parties that really fought about important things up there in Canada. We don't have anything like that here.
Well, it's just that we'd like to have a discussion about what this commitment is after 30 days and how long we'll be there, and will we have boots on the ground?
Right.
So we don't know the answer to any of those questions yet. But anyways, just thought you might be interested in what was happening up here Canada way.
Yeah, absolutely I am. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
All right, and yeah, I see here there's a couple that have just been published today here. This one is CBC News. ISIS fights Stephen Harper to brief conservative caucus on options within the next few days. So it really is important, a lot more important than I might pay attention to. But yeah, so thanks very much for that call. Very interesting stuff. If anybody wants to sneak in one more comment or question, I think we got time. If you want to call in, 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836. I guess I'll go back to this suicide bombing here by whether it was Nusra or ISIS this morning, whichever it was. And there's so much different news. I mean, damn, I guess I could be talking about how the U.S. and Turkey are not fighting ISIS. They're letting them go ahead and put the hurt on the PKK, commie Kurd rebels for a little while first. And that's just another insane scandal within this entire war. Just the way that they're doing this is just incredible. I mean, I almost don't know what to say about it. It's so crazy. The suicide attack. It's easy to go, oh, yeah, look, they're such butchers that we got to go get them. But come on, if you think about it for just 1 minute, they're such butchers that everybody hates them, and nobody wants them to be in charge. And it is true that sometimes an autocrat can seize power and nobody can stop them, but this isn't really that. ISIS is there now in Sunnistan, in western and northwestern Iraq, and in eastern Syria, with the consent of the governed, under compromises with the natural grassroots power that does exist in those communities. Their local religious leaders, the former Baathists, the tribal chieftains. And so... but they're such bastards. They really are. Horrible child killing. You could call them Democrats or Republicans. They're so brutal. And they're going to delegitimize themselves and run themselves right out of power and influence in those Sunni lands the same way they did in 2006. The best way to help see that end is to stay out of it.